It's time for justice. Welcome to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. on 97.3 FM WRIR and at www.wrir.org. I'm your host, Marty Wegbright. This show is written and produced by Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. We give free, civil, non-criminal legal aid to low-income people in Richmond, Petersburg, Charlottesville, and surrounding cities and counties. Coming up on this week's show...
So the basic coverage of the FLSA, what it provides, requires a minimum wage of $7.25 an hour for every hour worked. And the pay must be free and clear, which means that there can't be any improper deductions that would bring it below the minimum wage. So, for example, it's improper to deduct certain expenses that benefit the employer for tools of the trade, for example, or deducting workers' comp premiums, things like that. So it has to be free and clear, and of course it has to be paid directly to the worker. The worker has to receive the money. It can't be a bounced check, something like that. It requires overtime, which is time and a half times the regular rate for hours over 40 in one work week. So work week is going to be defined by the employer. It's going to be established, a seven-day period, 24 hours a day. And that work week has to remain. It can't be arbitrarily changed. So, for example, you can't say, well, we're just going to move the work week forward a couple of days so that we didn't get, you know, over 40 in that past work week. It has to be stable.
AFL CIO attorney Virginia Diamond explains your rights under the Fair Labor Standards Act, a federal law which sets strict rules about minimum wage, overtime pay, and pay for tipped employees. And during this week's News You Can Use, we'll tell you about an online system to apply for Medicaid and other public assistance, another benefit brought about by Obamacare. All that and more coming up. Stay with us. The show is supported in part by a grant from the Virginia Law Foundation. This show, number 206, is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society and gives only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford an attorney, we'll tell you later in the show how to get free legal advice or representation in a civil case. The Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show is heard every Wednesday at 12:30 on WRIR 97.3 FM Richmond Independent Radio and is made possible by community radio volunteers at WRIR. And now, this week's News You Can Use. Last month, the Virginia Department of Social Services won an award for Common Help, an internet portal where Virginians can apply for public assistance, including Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, Low-Income Home Energy Assistance, and Medicaid. Credit is due to the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, which requires states to allow consumers to apply for Medicaid online, regardless of whether the state participates in Medicaid expansion. The Obama administration offered a 90% match rate for the costs of design and development of Medicaid eligibility systems and a 75% match rate for maintenance, much more generous than the 50% rates typically offered. Despite opposing the Affordable Care Act, Governor McDonnell took the funding match, allowing Virginia to receive $52.7 million from the federal government over 2 years, while contributing only $9.5 million. These funds were used to modernize and enhance the online system, Common Help, so people can quickly find out if they are eligible for Medicaid and other types of federal assistance, and then easily sign up if they qualify. The website is commonhelp.virginia.gov. In other news, the Department of Housing and Urban Development, or HUD, is taking an unusual approach to the 7 unpaid days it is requiring most full-time employees to take due to the sequester. It is planning to shut down the agency on those days. The reason is unwanted paperwork. HUD officials assessed the logistics for personnel managers to organize days off for thousands of employees and concluded that the record keeping would be burdensome. So they will close down most agency operations on 7 days between April and the end of the fiscal year, September 30th. Don't look for HUD to be open May 10, May 24, June 14, July 5, July 22, August 16, and August 30. HUD has over 9,000 employees. Multiplying the number of employees by 7 days means there would be 63,000 scheduling decisions that would need to be made over a 6-month period. HUD called that prospect not administratively feasible and said the number of possible payroll errors would be daunting. However, other agencies apparently have not found this process as cumbersome and are letting employees choose which unpaid days to take, working out arrangements with their supervisors. With this week's News You Can Use, this is your host, Marty Wegbright. The Fair Labor Standards Act sets strict rules about minimum wage, overtime pay, and pay for tipped employees. AFL-CIO attorney Virginia Diamond explained your rights under this federal law in a presentation to the 2012 annual statewide Legal Aid Conference, and the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show was there. Here are Commissioner Diamond's remarks.
I'm going to talk about the provisions of the Fair Labor Standards Act. This is a New Deal law that was passed in 1935. I really think that there are so many aspects of the Fair Labor Standards Act that are really favorable to employees, much more so than a lot of other laws. I recommend the Department of Labor website. It's really great, and it's got fact sheets on all kinds of different issues. It's extremely helpful, so that's just a great place to go for looking things up. So the basic coverage of the FLSA, what it provides, requires a minimum wage of $7.25 an hour for every hour worked. And the pay must be free and clear, which means that there can't be any improper deductions that would bring it below the minimum wage. So, for example, it's improper to deduct certain expenses that benefit the employer for tools of the trade, for example, or deducting workers' comp premiums, things like that. So it has to be free and clear, and of course it has to be paid directly to the worker. The worker has to receive the money. It can't be a bounced check, something like that. It requires overtime, which is time and a half times the regular rate for hours over 40 in one work week. So work week is going to be defined by the employer. It's going to be established, a 7-day period, 24 hours a day. And that work week has to remain. It can't be arbitrarily changed. So, for example, you can't say, well, we're just going to move the work week forward a couple of days so that we didn't get, you know, over 40 in that past work week. It has to be stable. FLSA requires the employer to keep meticulous records of the employees, the data about the employees, the hours they worked, the amount that they were paid, deductions, etc. And that's all the responsibility of the employer. They have to keep those for 3 years. There's an anti-retaliation provision, which now prohibits retaliation in any form against workers who complain about violations of the FLSA. They can complain orally, or they can complain, you know, in writing. And they can complain to their company as well as to government agencies. Finally, the Equal Pay Act, and there are child labor law protections, also are part of the FLSA. The coverage is very broad. Covered enterprises, it covers almost everybody, because it not only does it cover enterprises that involve $500,000 in annual business, but it covers all enterprises where the employees are involved in interstate commerce, meaning that they handle items or goods that have ever been in interstate commerce. So it really is a very, very broad coverage of the types of enterprises. The definition of employment itself is also extremely broad under the FLSA. Employment, it's broader than the common law definition of employment, which is that the employer has the right to control the means and methods by which an employee does their work. The right to control is narrower. What the FLSA has is what's called the economic realities test. And what that says is that if the employee is in fact dependent upon the employer in reality, then there's an employment relationship. The person's not excluded as some kind of independent contractor. So the factors that are looked at to determine whether in reality, in economic reality, the worker is an employee of the employer. They look at not only the issue of control, but also the length of time they've been working there, the opportunities for profit or loss, whether the services are an integral part of the employer's business, and the amount of investment that's made in the business by the worker. So in a large majority of the cases where the business suffers or permits somebody to do work, that person will be considered an employee under the FLSA. So suffer and permit, in other words, if the person's allowed to do work for the employer and they're dependent on the employer, they don't have their own business, they're not going to be considered an independent contractor under the FLSA, even if under some other statute they might not be considered an employee but would be considered independent contractor. It's just a broader test. And then finally, the other issue that came up involves a joint employer responsibility. So what that says is that whatever employers are present, whether it's the general contractor and the subcontractor, or it's a labor contractor or a temp agency, the multiple employers are jointly and individually liable for FLSA violations. So you have an industrial laundry, you have a contract firm that places people in that laundry, they're both individually and jointly liable for any violations. And individuals can also be liable. Any individual acting directly or indirectly in the interest of an employer in relation to an employee is liable under the FLSA. So this is very important when you're going after an undercapitalized entity. And there are cases, for example, now there's a case going against Gristiti's, the food market chain. That is in bankruptcy, and there's a case against the CEO. There's another case involving a hotel where the corporation was sued as well as three managers. So that's one of the great things about the FLSA, is that you need to bring in anyone acting on behalf of the employer as well as the entity itself. There are numerous exemptions from the minimum wage and overtime requirements of the FLSA. However, these exemptions are required to be narrowly construed and strictly construed. And the burden is on the employer. And the Fourth Circuit has held that the burden is on the employer to prove with clear and convincing evidence that someone falls within an exemption to the FLSA. The largest group of exemptions is what they call the white-collar exemptions, which are labeled executive, administrative, and professional. Now, there's two things that you have to look at in determining whether someone falls within an exemption. One is the duties of the job, and the other is whether the person is paid on a salary basis. It's not certainly what their label is. So you could look at someone whose duties fall within one of these exemptions, but they don't qualify under the salary basis test, then they lose that exemption and they fall within the protections of the FLSA. Now, the executive exemption is defined as someone having their primary duty managing either an enterprise or a department or a subdivision. It's basically supervisors, people who supervise two or more full-time employees, and they have the authority to hire and fire those people, or at least to effectively recommend that, and that will be carried out. Now, where you get into an issue with the executive exemption would involve working foremen, say on a construction site, where you have someone who's the supervisor, but they're also working. Is their primary duty the management of the site, or is their primary duty doing the work? And so that would be something that would be looked at. What percentage of their time do they spend on that to see whether they would be exempt or not? The administrative exemption is often misclassified. The primary duty here involves performance of non-manual work directly relating to the employer's general business operations or interacting with customers. The key here is that it also requires that the person is able to exercise discretion and independent judgment regarding matters of significance for the company. So it's not just a white-collar person who works, you know, with the EO or with the employer. It's got to be someone who can exercise independent judgment, who can decide on their own to expend large amounts of money on behalf of the employer, who can deviate from established policies, who can give expert advice, who can be involved in long-term planning. So the administrative exemption is sometimes over-interpreted, and people are misclassified. Finally, the third white-collar exemption, the professional exemption, that involves work with specialized or advanced knowledge in science, prolonged study. It can be artistic or creative endeavors. There's also a group called learned professionals, who include, in many cases, registered nurses, registered or certified medical technologists, dental hygienists, physician's assistants, accountants, chefs. That list does not include paralegals.
You've been listening to AFL-CIO attorney Virginia Diamond explaining your rights under the Fair Labor Standards Act, a federal law which sets strict rules about minimum wage, overtime pay, and pay for tipped employees. We'll be back in a moment. We continue now with the remarks of AFL-CIO attorney Virginia Diamond about the Fair Labor Standards Act at a presentation to the 2012 Annual Statewide Legal Aid Conference.
Now, moving on to the salary basis. Number one, to fall within these exemptions generally, a person has to make at least $455 a week. So you do come up with cases where someone is manager of a store and they're not making $455 a week, they're not exempt. Secondly, the salary basis requires that there is a predetermined salary that is not subject to reductions based upon quality or quantity of work. So, for example, if someone has pay deducted from their salary because they are sick for half a day, that they lose the exemption. That's not a salary basis. And even if they are sick for a day and or have their pay reduced, that has to be in conjunction with a bona fide sick leave plan. So there are limited ways in which a salary can be reduced. For example, a major mistake involving a huge safety violation. That could possibly be okay and the exemption remain, or a bona fide sick leave program. But you can't reduce it for, you know, making small mistakes or for being absent for part of the day. Other big exemptions, outside sales representatives, they have to work primarily away from the business. There is no salary basis test for the outside salespeople. If they work inside more than 20% of the time, then they are no longer exempt. And certain computer professionals that involves engineers, programmers, systems analysts, certain of them, not all computer professionals, but some of them are exempt. They have a separate salary test that includes their hourly wages as well as their weekly wage. I'll run through just a bunch more exemptions. There are dozens of them. One is the motor carrier exemption, people who are involved in transporting goods or people in interstate commerce. In that case, if the vehicle, however, is under 10,000 pounds, then they don't fall within that exemption, and it does have to be interstate. Hospitals and nursing homes. Generally, RNs are exempt as a learned professional if they meet the salary basis test. LPNs and nurses' aides are not exempt as learned professionals. And the one thing that's different about hospitals and nursing homes is that they have the option of either using the 7-day, 40-hour work week, or they can use a 14-day period as their work week, as long as employees are paid overtime for hours over 8 in one day, and over 80 in a 14-day period. So there's some slightly different rules for hospitals. Companionship services, people who go into homes and work with the elderly or the infirm, are exempt. However, if they do general housework more than 20% of the time, then that exemption would be lost. Domestic service employees, however, are covered as long as they're not live-in or casual. Seasonal recreational establishments, exemption. Also, movie theater employees, certain car salespeople, taxi drivers, whoever had a good lobbyist the day that they were setting these exemptions were able to sometimes pull their people out. Exemptions also for highly compensated employees. If their employee earns over $100,000 a year, they're exempt. unless they're in construction, if they're doing manual labor. That would not create an exemption. Finally, there are special rules for tipped employees. Tips are counted towards the minimum wage so that the employer can take a tip credit of $5.15 an hour and only pay a cash wage of $2.13 an hour to reach the minimum wage. And overtime is calculated based on the minimum wage, not based on the amount of tips. Issues do come up, obviously, with many cases with restaurant workers, improper pooling of tips, but there are special rules for tipped employees. The person has to be paid least minimum wage for all hours worked. What is the compensable time? What are the hours that count? There was an amendment to the FLSA in the 40s called the Portal to Portal Act, which said that it doesn't cover work that's preliminary or post-liminary to the actual workday. However, if there's an activity, a preliminary activity or a post-liminary activity, that is integral and indispensable to the principal activity, then that is compensable. I'll just give an example of a case, Bull versus the United States, involving canine trainers for Homeland Security. And so they would train the dogs during the day, and they used these terry cloth towels with various scents on them. And then they would take the towels home, and they wash them in their washing machines and then bring them in the next day so they would be ready to be used again. The calculation was that took about 2 hours extra time a week, and the court found that that was integral and indispensable to their principal activities. And even though, you know, the employer might be able to say, well, I never told them to do that, I didn't know they were doing it, but the point is the towels came in clean every day, so they had to have a pretty good, they would reasonably be expected to figure out that these people were doing this work. And so these 60 workers ended up getting, you know, overtime for that, and recovered about, you know, $250,000 among them. So that's an example of that test. It often comes up in the issue of donning and doffing of protective gear. And so I guess the principal case on that was in 1956, Steiner v. Mitchell. It was a Supreme Court case involving battery plant workers. And they would go into work, and of course it was a very toxic environment. They got out of their regular clothes, got into their work clothes, and then at the end of the work they would take showers, leave the work clothes, and get into their regular clothes. So the issue was, does that donning and doffing of the work clothes count as work time? And the court said, yes, it does. It was an integral part of their activities. Waiting time or on-call time, the concept under the FLSA is, are you engaged to wait or waiting to be engaged? And the issue is, to what extent are you serving the employer and you do not have the use of your own time, you know, involved in sort of on-call activities? So if somebody is an on-call worker, but they can basically carry on their lives waiting for the call, that's not going to be compensable time. But if they are really constrained in terms of where they have to be and they're unable to really go use the time, then, or they're so frequently interrupted and have to do activities, then that could be covered. And, of course, workers who are standing around because they're waiting for the rain to stop or because something's not ready, that still would be compensable time even though they're waiting. Meal times, they're not compensable if they're 30 minutes or more, but the person has to be completely relieved of all their duties, even if they have to stay put. So, no, they have to be free to leave the station. They may have to stay on the premises, but they don't have to sit in their workstation. Then that meal time would not count. And basically travel time, commuting time is not compensable time, but if, say, a janitor has to report to one building and do the work and then travel to another building, then the time spent between the two buildings would be compensable time.
You've been listening to AFL-CIO attorney Virginia Diamond explaining your rights under the Fair Labor Standards Act, a federal law which sets strict rules about minimum wage, overtime pay, and pay for tipped employees. This is the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. That's all for this week's Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. This show is heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. The show is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. To see if you can get free civil legal aid, call during intake hours. These are Monday through Thursday, 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. and 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. The phone number is 200-6046 for intake, 648-1012 for the main number, and 1-800-868-1012 to call toll-free. You can get free legal information at the statewide legal aid website. This is www.valegalaid.org. You also may get free pre-recorded legal information by phone during non-business hours. These are before 9 a.m., after 5 p.m., and on weekends and legal holidays. Call toll-free 1-866-534-5243. If you have any comments on the show, you can email them to marty@cvlas.org. In addition, every first-run Central Virginia Legal Aid radio show ever broadcast is available at www.radioforall.net. That's radio, the numeral 4, all.net. Then click the contributor link, then click Marty Wegbright, Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. This show provides only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford one, call Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. Did you know that if you are fired from a job, you have a much better chance of getting unemployment compensation than if you quit your job? Join us next week when Legal Aid Justice Center attorney Pat Levy-Lavelle explains how to win your unemployment compensation hearing in a rebroadcast of a show originally heard on October 5, 2011. That's Law for the Rest of Us next week on the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. I'm Marty Wegbright. Oh.